This is Mark Lane.
This is Robert Groden.
This is Dick Russell.
This is Jim Mars.
This is Lisa Pease.
This is Dr. David Mantic.
This is Cyril Weck.
This is Jim DiEugenio.
This is Joan Mellon.
This is David Lifton.
This is Jerry Polycott.
This is Gary Shaw.
This is Bill Kelly.
This is Greg Burnham.
This is Gerald McKnight.
This is Sherry Feaster.
This is Joseph McBride.
This is Bill Davey.
This is Dave Ratcliffe.
This is David Talbot.
This is Doug Horn.
This is Walt Brown.
This is John Barber.
This is Judge Joe Brown.
This is Vince Palomera.
This is Bill Pepper.
This is Richard Belzer.
This is Oliver Stone.
This is Governor Jesse Ventura, and you're listening to Black Op Radio.
Video computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T-minus 30 seconds. T-minus 25 seconds. T-minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Satellite numbering verified.
T-minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite numbering verified.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek. Today, we are talking to author, researcher, Rob Couteau. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Len. Good to be back again. How are you?
Good. Very good. Thank you for taking part today. You have an article up at Kennedy's and King, which Jim DiEugenio brought to my attention. And then with email of you, I've got to go over. And I'd really like to talk about that today. The article is a biography of Stanley J. Marks, author of Murder Most Foul, The Conspiracy That Murdered President Kennedy. And I was unaware of that, and I thought that might be very interesting for other people who are unaware of Stanley Marks, that you could help inform us, and people can read your article and then review and then decide to look him up themselves.
Yes, indeed. Well, you know, it's funny because one of the wonderful things that happened in the course of all this research is that I was able to track down Stanley J. Marks' daughter, who's now 78, and she lives in Marina Del Rey, and we'll hopefully talk about her later. She was very helpful in helping me to flesh out this story. But the thing, you know, the crazy chain of events that led me to discover the book, Marx's daughter, her name is Bobby. Bobby and I refer to this as the Rube Goldberg chain of events. And this is how it starts. You know, I live a little bit north of New York City in a little college town. And back in 2013, I was in a long-distance relationship with a woman named Molly who lived in Portland. And after she discovered that I was interested in JFK, she stopped by Powell's bookstore one day, you know, the enormous bookstore in Portland, and she asked the clerk there if they had anything interesting on the assassination. And lo and behold, they just happened to be handling an estate sale of some extremely rare books on the JFK assassination. So she put me on the phone with the clerk, and, you know, he gave me a brief synopsis of each book. There were about a half a dozen books. To give you one example, there was a very rare first edition and mimeograph of The Bastard Bullet by Raymond Marcus. And there were some other things. And then there was this book that I'd never heard of before, Murder Most Foul, The Conspiracy That Murdered President Kennedy, subtitled 975 Questions and Answers. So I thought, you know, that's such an unusual title. I said, yeah, sure, just include that, you know. So anyway, when the package came, I was looking through each book, and, you know, Len, I wasn't paying careful enough attention. I picked up the Stanley J. Marks book. I opened it up, thumbing through it, and I opened up to a section on the Warren Commission. And I thought, you know, I'm already sold on the fact that the Warren Commission was a sham. And so much time has gone by since 1967, which is when this book was self-published. I kind of forgot about the book and put it down and stuck it on my bookshelf. And it stayed there for 5 years. And in 2018, after some spring cleaning, I decided to stick it on eBay. And it sits there for 19 months. Can you guess the day the book got sold?
No, not at all.
Murder Most Foul. 26th of March, I wake up that morning, I say, oh, somebody bought it. So I go online just to see, you know, is there anybody else still selling this book? When I first heard of the book, there was maybe one or two people that had it. I had the last copy for sale. So I go online, I Google the title, and I see the photograph that I had taken of the book cover. And it, by the way, it's got a very distinctive look, the copy I had, because it had some dust staining and sun tanning. So I knew the photograph I had taken. So my photograph of this book is now reproduced on dozens and dozens of Dylan blogs all across the internet. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? Well, the date was the 26th of March. That was the day that Variety magazine announces this Dylan song called Murder Most Foul. Okay. And the guy who bought the book was actually, you know, pretty well-known Dylan blogger. So the next step in the Rube Goldberg contraption, the next day I upload the book cover, put it on my Facebook, and I wrote, the title of Dylan's new song about JFK is lifted from one of the early books about the assassination, Murder Most Foul, by Stanley Marks. So, of course, the eagle eye of Jim DiEugenio immediately spots my post, and he writes back, I hate to admit this, but I've never heard of that book. Has anyone read it? Well, does anyone have it? And, you know, Len, the book was packaged and sealed and all ready to go. And only because I was too lazy the day before to go to the post office did we still have a copy of that book, right? So thank God Jim had responded that way. And I wrote him back and I said, you know, I have it. And he said, well, can you give me a summary of the book? So I unpacked it. And then I started to look carefully at it. And I realized, wait a minute, this book has got some things in it that nobody else in 1967 was writing about. So that's what led us to this whole thing.
Right. And like I was mentioning, I hadn't heard of it.
Right.
I didn't know of it. Yeah.
I'll give you an example. You know, when I started looking at it more carefully, this is what I happened to open up to, this quote. He's talking about, this is at the very end of the book, by the way, where the really juicy stuff is, in the postscript, which is the last chapter. And it's got some very well-reasoned critiques against the media whitewash conducted by, you know, at that time, the three major networks, NBC, ABC, CBS. So he writes, this is the first thing my eye spotted, quote, that the CIA controls many of the news columns in both the press and magazines is now well known. What is not known and what will never be known is how many agents of the CIA now work for various organs in the mass communication media. And I thought, you know, there certainly weren't many people thinking about this in 1967, right?
I mean, hardly anybody.
Right, right. So I actually scanned the entire book so that I would have a copy, and I sent a copy to Jim. But at first, I just sent him the last 17 pages. Because, as I mentioned before, the subtitle of this is 975 questions and answers about the JFK assassination. So that, you know, the other innovative thing about the book is this guy was stylistically innovative, because other people are just writing straight narratives, which can tend to be a bit boring sometimes, you know. But he was an attorney. He had graduated law school. And so he presents the book as if he's prosecuting the Warren Commission. And he's asking rhetorical Q&As in a court of law, right? And this goes on, like, through the whole book until you get to the last 17 pages. It's like he builds up this scaffolding of facts. And when I say facts, I mean, you know, like Sylvia Meagher and like Mark Lane and Joachim Jostin and other early authors about the assassination, he used the Warren Commission's own research, conclusions against it, you know, because you've got the FBI report saying one thing, the Secret Service report saying another thing, and then you've got the Warren Commission completely contradicting those two reports, and then anything that wasn't convenient to their conclusions, they either buried in the 26 volumes of hearings, or they discreetly shuffled it off to the National Archives, where a lot of it was quote-unquote lost, you know. So Marx relies on these government documents to prove, as a lawyer in a court of law, in an imaginary hearing, that there was a conspiracy. So, you know, he builds up this case for 975 questions and answers, and then he takes a little break, sort of standing on the scaffolding of facts, and he looks ahead at what's going to happen to the country as a result of this horrible thing that the Warren Commission has done. And so those last 17 pages focus on that, and that was the first thing that I sent to Jim, and I said, you know, you're going to find some gems in there. And he wrote me back that same day, and he said, thanks for that. He said, you know, this guy was way ahead of his time, and if Dylan was referencing this book, it really speaks well for him.
Yeah, it sounded to me like it was like a deposition.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah,
it's a good word. We don't know too much about him. I don't, other than you mentioned he was a lawyer. What can you tell me about Stanley Marx? Were you able to find out anything? He self-published the book, so nobody picked it up.
Yes, I mean,
been too controversial.
I believe that was one of the problems, and there were other authors like Joachim Jostin who were unable to publish their books. You know, his book was Oswald Assassin or Fall Guy. He couldn't publish that in the United States. He had to self-publish it. I think that was part of the problem. I think the other thing is, you know, this guy in the course of his life, he self-published over 20 books. And my impression, as I've read through a number of them, is that I think he wanted editorial control over the content. And in fact, when I later was able to make contact with his daughter, Bobby Marx, who's out in California, she agreed. She said that there was one time she tried to convince him to work with an editor, but he wouldn't hear of it. So I think, you know, there's also that explanation. But, you know, I wanted to say that even if this guy didn't write about JFK, the rest of his life is utterly fascinating, which I want to get to in a moment. And I describe him as a kind of Zelig-like figure of 20th century history. You know the movie Zelig? You know what I'm referencing there, Len?
I'm not familiar with it.
It was a movie that came out years ago by Woody Allen. And this figure, Zelig, he always seems to appear at the right moment, you know, in the right place and right time. And that's what this guy, Stanley Marx, is a bit like. Because I'll give you an example. I'll just give you a quick rundown. So he's born in 1914. 4 years later, he's 4 years old. Both his parents died in the 1918 flu pandemic, which was referred to as the Spanish flu. So he's orphaned at 4 years old. He's then adopted. He was in Chicago. So he's then adopted. I'm saying adopted. He was put under the care of foster parents who were Russian Jewish immigrants from originally from Russia, and they were, you know, living in a ghetto in Chicago. He's a first generation American. Because his parents were also probably from Russia. He graduates from Chicago's only public law school. You know, he's living with a very poor family. The foster father was like a tinsmith. So, and they gave him no intellectual encouragement at all. So somehow, he not only gets through university, but then he graduates from a public law school right in the midst of the Great Depression, towards the end of the Great Depression, he accumulates a 5,000-book library. Then he conducts research.
Pardon me, did you say 5,000?
5,000-book library.
Wow.
Okay. And by the way, all the stuff that I'm telling you now, this is what I discovered through research in the last 4 months. This guy is new to me as well. And it's just mind-boggling. So he builds up this 5,000-book library, which is about military science and politics and history. He decides to write this book in the late 30s about the Soviet Union and how the Soviet Union, which was, you know, our ally during the Second World War, is sort of being treated as, you know, sort of being like kept at arm's distance by the Western powers in many ways. So it's about Soviet Union. He conducts this research with the approval of the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, the longest serving Secretary of State in U.S. history, gives him access to State Department files to write this book. We don't know how this happened. He publishes a widely reviewed bestseller, which, by the way, was published with a vanity press. You know what a vanity press is? Have you heard that expression, Len?
Oh, no, not as an expression. I thought you meant the magazine.
No, so a vanity press, you know, in the years before, like, self-publishing software and the internet, you could pay a vanity press to publish your book. You would pay them. And they would produce your book. And, you know, usually this was like amateur authors who wanted to see their name in print. And, you know, they would deliver a trunk load of books. And then you'd be stuck with these books, no publicity, nothing. So this was a self-published book, essentially, right? And this vanity press publishes his book, but they don't charge him anything. Another thing we can't figure out, the publisher, by the way, was Durant's. They were called Durant's Publishing. I'll talk about them later. Bobby Marks, Stanley's daughter, dug up the original contract from 1942, which, by the way, was drawn on September 11th, 1942. So I said that must be a propitious date for so-called conspiracy researchers, right? But the contract is a normal book contract. They didn't charge him. They paid for the publication. So it's essentially a self-published book, and it becomes a widely reviewed bestseller. This book was reviewed in mainstream media in about 30 major newspapers across the country. Then he ends up teaching, this is in 1943, the book came out on the Soviet Union came out in February. He ends up that same year teaching at this remarkably avant-garde school called the Abraham Lincoln School of Social Science, which I'd also like to talk to you about in a moment. That school was became surveilled by the NSA and the FBI because it was so progressive and ahead of its time. Marx also became a regular book reviewer and essayist for the Chicago Defender, which was the biggest and most influential African-American newspaper in the United States. I believe by the 1920s, it had a circulation of over 200,000. And this newspaper played an incredibly central role in the civil rights movement because in 1916, they started a campaign to encourage blacks to leave rural South where they were under so much racial pressure and to come north and work in Chicago factories and things like that. So this paper basically started what was later called the Great Migration North. So Marx wrote book reviews and essays about politics for the Chicago Defender. Chicago Defender was also put under surveillance by the FBI, and J. Edgar Hoover actually convinced President Roosevelt, FDR, to prosecute the black editors for treason. And it was only because of the intervention of Eleanor Roosevelt, who set up a meeting with the Attorney General Biddle, who was an incredibly left of center influence in the FDR administration. That didn't happen. So Marx is appearing, you know, in all these Zelig-like moments. And then in 1944, because of this work he did, and because of the book on the Soviet Union, which was pro-Soviet, which was okay at the time to be pro-Soviet. They were our ally, right? In the Second World War, millions of Russians died fighting the Nazis. The House Un-American Activities Committee in 1944 blacklisted Stanley J. Marx, and they issued, the House Un-American Activities Committee issued a report on so-called un-American activities, and Stanley's name appears three times in that report. That's in 1944. 4 years later, there's another House Un-American Activities report published with U.S. taxpayer dollars by the Government Printing Office in 1948. You know, that's when they were prosecuting a lot of actors and actresses in Hollywood trying to get publicity. And Stanley Marx's name appears in that report also, along with Dalton Trumbo, who wrote Johnny Got His Gun. There's a whole bunch of pages on Trumbo in that book, in that report. So for all this amazing work he's done, he gets blacklisted in 1944. The following year, in 1945, Stanley Marx is serving under General MacArthur in the Pacific. And while he's a private, a half dozen newspaper articles in the spring of 1945 appear in mainstream Texas newspapers talking about Private Marx and how he knows more than his superiors about military science, and they've commissioned him to write a 750-page book on military history. And so there's like, he's blacklisted, but the following year, there's like a half dozen praiseworthy articles about him, also talking about, one of them even mentions the fact that he taught at the Abraham Lincoln School. So I think, you know, this shows us that there was this schism between the FDR liberals and the oncoming right-wing maniacs that would take over this country in those years of red baiting during the 50s. And then it seems like in the 50s he got involved with some businesses to try to make ends meet. I think it's possible because of the blacklist he wasn't allowed to practice law, but we don't really know. In any case, he later settled in LA with his wife. They wanted to be near their daughter who had relocated there, so they finally left Chicago. And then he went on to publish 22 other books. Four of them are about the assassinations. A fifth book, published in 1970, is actually a play about the three major assassinations, JFK, RFK, and Martin Luther King. And then in 1979, the House of Representatives Select Subcommittee on Assassinations issued its report that March. They cited five of his books in their bibliography. Okay? So it's just this absolutely incredible story. And in addition to that, the other really crazy thing is that the JFK Library wrote Marx a letter saying they'd like to purchase Murder Most Foul to add to their library collection. That was also in the 1970s. Len, how strange is that? I mean, have you ever heard of a presidential library wanting to purchase a so-called conspiracy theory book?
Wow. And the amount of books this guy has written, I'm going to have to find out more about him. I'm so glad you just accidentally found this.
Yeah, I mean, we're just so lucky that, you know, it all played out that way in that Rube Goldberg kind of fashion, you know?
Well, in your article here, why don't we start off for people who don't know too much about what he really wrote in this book. Let's start with the part one that you have, which is getting into all these questions and answers, and maybe go through a few of them.
Okay. Well, you know, one thing that really caught my attention when I was first thumbing through the book, not the first time I was thumbing through the book, but when we decided to take a more careful look at the book, this, I thought, was another incredible remark to be making in 1967. Again, he's critiquing the Warren Commission, and he says, what is meant by, quote, against the national interest, end of quote? That's the rhetorical question. And the answer he poses is, he says, the Warren Commission has never defined this undefinable phrase. However, after the publication of the Warren Report, and he puts report in quotation marks, you know, to imply, you know, this is no report, many commentators and historians interpret that phrase to mean that whenever a future president is murdered, his killers can escape capture and punishment if a future investigating committee decides their capture would be against the national interest.
Wow. You know, it just reminds me of when the Saudis murdered that guy, chopped him up, and then
right.
Trump is out there, well, you know, they might have handled it, but I'm going to get a good deal on oil now, so everybody, you know, turn away, nothing to see here.
I know. And God, you know, let's not even get started on Trump. It's just, we're so fed up with him in this country, you know, and I'm sure he's going to try to steal the election, but that's a whole other interview, you know. The other interesting thing about Marx is that, you know, it could be, as you know, especially when you're focusing on the Warren Commission report, it can be very tedious because there's all of these little facts and figures that you've got to go through and tear apart. One of the things I found really refreshing about his book is that, you know, like a lot of hyper-intellectuals, the way he gets in touch with emotion is through humor, through wry, witty humor. And there are so many sort of comedic asides that he takes in this book that remind me of like a Mort Sahl or Lenny Bruce or even a Groucho Marx, you know. Even some of the chapter headings. So for example, you know, there's that whole thing about how the first rifle that the police found at the Texas Book Depository was not a Carcano Italian rifle. It was a German Mauser. And then there are actually two completely different Carcano rifles that we have photographs of that appeared in press reports. So chapter three of the book is of Marx's book. He titles Rifles, Rifles Everywhere. And, you know, he kind of, you know, uses this kind of goofy Groucho Marxian humor to pepper the book, you know. In another place, he's talking about the FBI tests. And this is question 252. What would a law court say about this final FBI test? The answer is that the tests were as phony as plastic baloney. So, you know, a lot of it is just, he's just laughing at the report, you know. You know, and then there's also some very, very sharp and pointed attacks against the former CIA director, Alan Dulles. And I have to hand it to Stanley. I mean, you know, again, a lot of people weren't thinking about Alan Dulles in regard to the assassination. But he really lets them have it, you know, quite justifiably. He even quotes that article that Dulles wrote in, or was quoted from in Look magazine in 66, July 1966. Dulles says in the article, if they found another assassin, let them name names and produce their evidence. You know, he's criticizing the people who didn't believe in the report. And Marx replies to this, and he says, this contemptuous statement directed at the American citizenry revealed the attitude of the commission. The commission did not praise the president. They gave him a funeral and used his shroud to conceal his murderers. And I thought, wow, that's, you know, that's really to the point. You know, another thing is, well, what makes this guy so different than some of the other authors of the time? And definitely it's the fact that no other author, I think, in 1967 was using polemic so often or so effectively or powerfully. It's a very, you know, although it's based on fact, there's a lot of, you know, powerful polemic in this book that he uses really to wake people up. And so, you know, as I often do when I'm investigating a subject, you know, in America, we don't have the French Academy. The Académie Française, you know, in France determines the meaning of words and the validity of phrases and so on. I turn to the Merriam-Webster's dictionary, since we don't have an academy here like that. And I looked up the word polemic. And it was a very interesting one because it derives originally from Greek term, but the closest derivation was from the French, polemique, which means controversial. And then before that, the Greek polemikos means warlike or hostile. And then an earlier Greek term, it means to shake. And I thought, you know, this is really what Marx is doing, because through this polemic, he shakes us up, produces controversy, and utilizes it as an instrument of war. Like, we say the pen is mightier than the sword. And I think that's the other really important thing about Murder Most Foul, is that, as I say, once he dispenses with all the Q&As, the final 17 pages, it shifts into a straight narrative. And it's kind of like a no-holds-barred window into his apoplectic indignation over what this report is trying to do. And the chapter title of that first chapter, where it goes into straight narrative, it's called The Rape of the American Conscience.
Yeah, what a title. I mean, you know, you're mentioning his dry humor, the chapter 2, The Fraudulent Autopsy, or How to Lie in a Military Manner, right?
Right.
The next chapter, The Non-Existent Paper Bag, or How to Manufacture Evidence.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's just, you know what's going to happen. You're ready for that chapter, and you go, okay, this is going to be good.
Yeah. And you know, in this ending of the book part, there's another great quote. He says, the members of the commission did not achieve their status in the American social, economic, and political scale by being stupid. Therefore, one can only conclude that these seven, referring to the seven commissioners, had some understanding, whether spoken or implied, that this nation of 195 million souls would be torn asunder if the commission reported to them that a conspiracy had murdered President John F. Kennedy. Yet these seven men placed their honor upon a report that would wilt in the noonday sun.
Well, I've often made this observation to people who talk about the mafia, organized crime, you know, running
right.
the whole thing. And I say, imagine the poverty of that a mafia guy did kill your president and totally got away with, and there's nothing. They're just running free. They didn't investigate organized crime. They didn't do anything about it. So if
right.
it's true, you're going to tell me Carlos Marcello, whoever did this, you know, what kind of FBI or justice system do you have?
Exactly.
And when they can mock you, and it kind of shuts them up.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you bring that up, the mocking, because he also addresses this. This is, again, from the end of the book. He says, criticism is derived from critics, and they should not be immune in turn. When, however, the critics are attacked on the basis of personality instead of the measure of their facts, then it is a sign that the criticism has been correctly established, you know? And it's really interesting if you take that quote and then, you know, we later find out from declassified CIA memo that it was the CIA itself that first floated the strategy of attacking Warren Commission critics as mere quote-unquote conspiracy theorists, right? And
now, that's,
you know,
true.
You know what I noticed, Len, the other day when I was putting this together and I got an actual copy of that memo. That memo came out in 1960. I mean, that memo was produced. It remained secret in 1967. But you know what day that memo was written on? April Fool's Day, April 1st. I don't think anyone's pointed that out before. What a great April Fool's Day message, you know?
Well, from your review and from some of the things that you quoted, it almost sounds like he had such a grasp of what really happened,
right,
that, like Garrison, he was just ahead of his time.
Yeah, he really was. Yeah.
You know, he makes a good point of Oswald's marksmanship and some of these things that are off the record and then come back on and there's no questions. You know, I guess by being a sharp lawyer, he was able to recognize when something is missing, it must be for an important reason. Otherwise, they would have been waving it like a flag. And
that's an excellent point, what you just brought up, because I think there's actually two things that might account for why he was ahead of the curve compared to people like Hosea Thompson, 6 Seconds in Dallas. He waffled at the end of the book in terms of whether there was even a conspiracy, right? I think there are two things at work there. One is the fact that you could almost view Marx as a European. I mean, you know, he was a first generation American. He grew up in basically a Russian Jewish ghetto. And so he had a European's point of view about all this, meaning that a deeper sense of history. And, you know, secondly, he had accumulated that 5,000 book library all about military science, politics, and history. So for him, it would just be a natural assumption that the first thing you look at would be whether this was a conspiracy, not the last thing. That would not be the last question. You know, I think the other thing that's important to point out is that when we say that Marx was, and I hope we can get into this later, you know, besides the fact that he pointed out that there was a conspiracy and that the CIA was involved and Alan Dulles was a crucial figure here, and he knew all that by 1967, he also knew that Garrison was the real deal. Whereas Sylvia Meagher and Harold Weisberg and Anthony Summers made fun of Garrison, people who should have known better. This guy, all on his own, knew Garrison was the real deal. And the postscript of the book, by the way, has Garrison in the title. He calls him St. George versus the Dragon, right? But I think the other thing that's important to point out is that Marx was one of the first American researchers to conclude very early on that the same forces that were at work in murdering President Kennedy were also involved with the assassinations of Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King. He was possibly, even before Garrison reached that conclusion, Marx reached that conclusion, and it's published in his subsequent books. His book, his second book on the assassination, I believe, came out in March 1969. And he's talking about that. So if we view him in terms of being ahead of the curve on that fact, that he was already talking about the same people involved in the conspiracy, that's way ahead of the time for an American researcher. European researchers, no, they knew that already. And but I see Marx as sort of coming more out of that European tradition. And to give you an example of what I'm talking about, when Oliver Stone released his film JFK in 1992, my interest in the assassination research got rekindled. You know, I was at it before then, but like with many people, this is like a nice boost. And at the time, I was living in Paris. And whenever I brought up the subject, the French rarely, if ever, spoke about the assassination attempts on President de Gaulle's life, because that was too recent. Instead, they would talk about the assassination attempts on King Henry IV, the French King Henry IV, who was King of France from 1589 to 1610, right? So they had this in their consciousness for over four centuries. And they would say, oh yes, JFK was like le bon roi Henri, the good King Henry, because they both cared about the common people. And that's why they were both killed. And there were at least a dozen attempts on King Henry's life before they finally killed him in 1610. So I think Europeans have that broader perspective.
Well, this is something that I just wanted to bring up, a couple of things I'll get to now. One was that you said he was such a student of military tactics. Mm. Could it be that he just recognized that, oh, this was an assassination, this was a military, this isn't some, you know, Khrushchev or Castro, this is like a military operation that he just recognized?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he talks about, even in this first book, he talks about not only the CIA, but the anti-Castro Batista units that were being used by the CIA. And, you know, he talks about the FBI cover-up, participating in the cover-up of the Warren Report and all of that stuff. Yeah, he was quite aware of that. I think the other amazing thing is that in the conclusions that he reaches at the end of the book, he asks some very chilling questions. Like, for example, he says, to whom does the American public go to seek the truth? And then he answers it by saying, it can now be said that the American people do not believe anything stated in the report. Again, report in quotation marks. Due to this lack of belief, a cynicism has now gathered among the citizenry that bodes ill for the nation. A nation whose moral fiber has been torn and shattered cannot long live, for when the nation's spirit is destroyed, no nation will live. And so, you know, he's saying that in 1967, we're living through the repercussions of what he predicted right now. And another place he says, people in all nations must stand for an ideal. The United States of America was not born on the idea that its president could be shot like a dog in the street and his murderers be shielded from this day on because it would be against the national interests. And then go ahead.
Well, I was just going to mention the national interest that you say he had in quotes, and earlier you brought that up, right?
Right.
Just what is the national interest? That of the people, or that of the businesses who own it?
The military-industrial complex, exactly. And then, you know, again, he uses certain, you know, another quirky thing about this guy that I love about this guy is that, and I don't think he could have gotten away with this if he didn't self-publish, he's got a lot of very quirky grammatical things. Like, for example, he capitalizes, almost like you're reading Old English from 400 years ago, he capitalizes certain nouns and adjectives, and he capitalizes the word spirit. And he says the spirit in this year of 1967 has been replaced by cynicism of everything American. And he puts American in quotes. There was a spirit when John F. Kennedy was president of the United States. there was a feeling that the United States of America was moving toward a goal enunciated in the preamble of the Constitution. The youth, and he capitalizes youth, which a nation, he capitalizes nation, must have to exist, had a feeling within them that the nation did not care for the future. There is no spirit today. And, I was very touched by the fact that he capitalizes both the term nation and youth as if to show their equivalence and to remind us that these are sacred forces that we need in order for a society's future to exist and to flourish. So I think you really nailed it in some of those remarks, you know.
Now, one question I wanted to bring up that you got by quickly, it's, I want to ask you about his daughter, and how did you connect with her, and how did you bring this up? Just tell me about tracking her down.
Oh, it was amazing because, and I have to say, you know, getting in touch with Bobby Marks and talking with her on the phone, I mean, we have become so close. And it's really the most wonderful thing to come out of this project. She's just such an amazing human being. She was completely gobsmacked by this whole thing. You know, her father never really got the attention he deserved. And she's sort of laughing through the whole thing because it's almost like it's funny to her that this connection has been made. And, you know, she was crucial in tying up a lot of loose ends because here I am in my cave. I worked on this every single day for over a month. I was obsessed with it. And like I said about him being a Zelig-like figure, you know, I kept finding out more and more incredible things. And I'm like, who is this guy? Why has no one heard of this guy? And I felt kind of isolated in this. And so at the beginning, Len, I went on Ancestry.com and Newspapers.com. And fortunately, Murder Most Foul, to answer your question, Murder Most Foul back cover mentions the title of the book about the Soviet Union, which I have right here. It's called The Bear That Walks Like a Man, A Diplomatic and Military Analysis of Soviet Russia. So it mentioned that title. So I ordered a copy. There were still a few copies that existed of The Bear That Walks Like a Man. By the way, since my article has come out, Kennedys and King, it's almost impossible to find any of the over 22 books this guy published because people are grabbing them. You know, they're selling like the few that remain sold like hotcakes. But when I ordered The Bear, I opened it up and lo and behold, there's in the acknowledgments page, he mentions the name of his daughter and his wife. So with that information, I was able to create a tree on Ancestry.com, and things started popping up as a result of that. And long story short, there were some articles about Bobby Marks because she ran some very successful businesses out in California. And so I was able to track down where she must have been living. And I finally found her online, just on some of these people finder sites. And I wrote her a letter. And I waited with great expectation, and she wrote me back thanking me for my interest. And she said, but unfortunately, I don't think I can help you because I've never read my father's books. And I thought, oh my God, so close and so far. She, for some reason, she's not interested in this. So I wrote her back a second letter, and I said, look, we don't have to talk about your father's books, but I have to talk to you because your father led this amazing life. And, you know, I need to find out even little things. What do you remember about him? So she picked up the phone and called me one day, and we are like best friends forever now. We spoke on the phone like every day for the first 2 weeks. The funny thing is, I think Stanley and his wife tried to protect her from knowing too much. She never knew he was blacklisted. She was never told that his name appeared in these House on American Activities reports. She said, you know, my parents knew I was a warrior. Maybe they didn't want me to know. She'd never heard about how Secretary of State Cordell Hull had helped Stanley get access to State Department files. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but Cordell Hull was credited with being the most influential, founder of the United Nations. FDR called him the father of the United Nations. This is an incredibly important man. She'd never heard of many of these things, but she did know some other things that helped to flesh out the story. And most importantly, she helped me feel connected to Stanley, you know, because she's such an incredible human being. It's like I think Bobby Marks was Stanley and Ethel's greatest creation. She's just an amazing person. And she said that when she was growing up, Stanley was so obsessed about politics and all the awful things that were going on. She said, you know, and we included this letter in the article. She said, you know, when you're in your teens and 20s, you don't want to hear about how horrible the world is. You want to go out and live in the world. So she kind of tuned him out. But now, with Donald Trump in control, she's gotten very political. And she said, you know, I've really become my father's daughter.
Wow, you know, the whole story reminds me of this documentary called Searching for Sugarman. Did you ever see that?
No, what's that about?
Oh, it's about a musician who was very big in Europe and South Africa. And this guy goes out to try to find him. And he finds him working in, I think, Detroit as a bricklayer. You know, and he goes to tell him, did you know that these people... Anyway, it's if you don't know it, but it's a similar thing where they just find this guy who they
right.
didn't realize how important his music was. It's a great
there
documentary. Yeah. So I can hear the excitement you had of, you know, doing this family tree searching and looking at the internet for people and then finally finding somebody and then they don't have all the answers right away, but you get them to open up a bit, and then before you know it, there's a lot of stuff there.
Yeah. I mean, it was just so amazing. You know, one of the things I mentioned before, that he served under General MacArthur in the South Pacific. The way I found out about that was that it's mentioned on some of the blurbs that he puts about himself on the back covers of some of these books, you know, that he was in the South Pacific Theater. But I couldn't figure out, like, when he was first inducted into the Army or where exactly he was and so on. And Bobby actually had an artist sketch that was made of Stanley while he was in the Philippines. And more recently, she uncovered a box of some of his old papers. And there was that's when we found out about the request from the JFK Library to purchase the book. And also there was a letter of commendation from commander of a ship that was stationed in the Philippines at the end of 1945. And the commander of the ship wrote this letter of commendation to Stanley for producing a daily newsletter, which helped to lift morale on the ship. So he was always writing, you know, in some capacity. The JFK Library thing is interesting because I recently found out that, you know, you've heard of Dave Powers, the special assistant to JFK?
Yes, yeah.
Right? So in 1964, Bobby Kennedy asked Powers to begin to collect Kennedy memorabilia that would later be deposed in the official JFK Library that didn't exist yet. And the following year, Powers moved all the material to the National Archives Federal Records Center in Waltham, Massachusetts. And the next 14 years, him and his staff organized this collection, which finally became the official JFK Presidential Library. So Powers was in charge of the library in the 70s when this request came, you know, which Roberta scanned and sent to me. It's a letter, you know, written on official Office of U.S. General Services Administrations. And then under that it says, you know, John F. Kennedy Library asking to purchase a copy of the book. And I thought, you know, not even Jim DeEugenio has heard about this because we just found this the other day. And I thought, you know, this is just very, very strange and unusual. And how did they find out about him? But, you know, somehow they did.
Tell me a little more then about a couple of things that maybe caught your eye as you're going through the book. What is the catalyst that really had you to write about an article about it? You know, meaning this is so important, people have to know about them.
Ah, okay, good question. So you're saying as I went through The Murder Most Foul?
Yeah, because, I mean, everybody knows some of the facts, and I'm sure you know most of the facts. So it'd just be if I opened up another book on the assassination, something have to be really important for me to think, oh, people have got to know this.
Good question. Okay, let's see. Well, you know, I think one of the most important or at least moving things he says in the book, I refer to it as a kind of clarion call. And this is in this final 17 pages. He says, how long, America, will we commit our silence to perpetuate the evil in the Warren Report? And I thought, you know, if we changed the Warren Report to national security state and said, how long, America, will we commit our silence to perpetuate the evil in the national security state? That's sort of where we've ended up. And as he's saying, I think that the Warren Report had a big role to play in this, in terms of not only feeding people's mistrust about the national security state, but also the sense of hopelessness that it's given us. And so we're now, you know, as opposed to the New Deal philosophy that Stanley very much identified with, we're now at this point where we're agreeing with positing the military as the most powerful influence to determine a nation's direction, as well as its highest form of authority. I think that's a very dangerous thing, and Marx certainly saw that it was leading there. And again, another important thing is we were talking about Jim Garrison before. So the postscript is titled Jim Garrison, St. George versus the Dragon. And, you know, Marx realized that Garrison as St. George was up against the state-sponsored dragon. And he says, again, this book came out in September of 67. So he says, by the time this book appears in print, the Kennedy conspiracy may claim another victim, none other than Jim Garrison, the DA of New Orleans, whose lance of truth has pierced vital organs of the conspiracy that murdered President Kennedy. And he even goes on to wonder, you know, are they going to kill him before he finishes the Clay Shaw trial, or are they just going to, you know, destroy his reputation?
Yeah, character assassination.
Right? Yeah, and he makes this prediction that comes to pass. He says, this is on the last page of the book. He says, the media may succeed, because he ties this into the corporate media. That's another thing way ahead of this time. And he says, the media may succeed, for as the day for the Clay Shaw trial approaches, the greater use of the media for the perpetration of the lie increases. If the forces behind the conspiracy cannot destroy Mr. Garrison's case, they may decide to destroy the man either physically or by reputation. And then he ties that into the media, and he says, this is the quote that I read before, that the CIA controls many of the news columns in both press and magazines is now well known. What is not known and what will never be known is how many agents of the CIA now work for various organs in the mass communication media. Again, think about that today. Like, I don't know how much you tune into American television, so-called news shows, but, you know, even to this day, a lot of Americans are not aware of this arrangement, you know, and this cozy relationship between sheep-dipped agents and major networks hiring so-called former Intel operators. Today, they don't even bother to hide their, you know, supposed past credentials. You'll see, like on CNN, so-and-so served in the CIA under this or that title. They don't even worry about it anymore.
Yeah, they said that about Anderson Cooper, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's right.
And now it's like, oh, well, of course I worked for the CIA.
Yeah, of course. What better credential, right? You know, it's ludicrous.
And he's serving, quote, the national interest. Unquote.
There you go. I'm glad you picked up on that term, because that really has so much to do with what we're talking about today, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I haven't read his book yet, but just going, you know, through your article. And I hope people that are interested listening to this will go and read. I'll make a link to it at Kennedy's and King. Let me ask you this.
Yeah.
How can people get the book? It sounds like there isn't any more around.
That's a great question. And I've got a great answer for you. My agent is currently involved in trying to find a publisher who would be interested in producing the biography that I've written about Stanley Marks. So the article that is at Kennedy's and King is only about a third to a quarter of my longer piece. And in addition to that, we're hoping that somebody, you know, a good big publisher will be interested in reissuing some of Stanley Marks's key books. And the first one we're going to try for is Murder Most Foul.
Okay, so you're already on an angle for that to get it republished?
We're on it. Yeah, we really want to get it out there again. And we've got the support of Bobby Marks. So I think it's going to happen.
Okay, sure. Well, keep in touch with me for sure. And I'll let people listening know about that.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
All right. Well, then let's talk a little bit just about the last 17 pages, then his conclusions and how you interpret what he was trying to warn us of.
And I didn't hear the last thing. How I interpret what?
Just what he was trying to warn us of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's some other really interesting points he makes in there. You know, one thing that, again, I think was very ahead of its time was the fact, and actually this leads into his second book, you know, was the fact that the commission did not exist in a vacuum, that there were economic interests behind this, you know. So, for example, again, talking about the media and Garrison, this quote really, I thought, was really prescient, thinking about the fact that this is from 53 years ago. He says, various members of the mass communication media bribed witnesses, hid witnesses, issued fraudulent interviews, had witnesses file suit against Mr. Garrison. He's talking about the Clay Shaw trial here. Produced nationwide television programs which upheld the findings of the Warren Commission. How incredible. Why? The answer to why can be found in the fact that many of the inactive and active participants of the conspiracy will be found in the ranks of government and the economic strata of our nation. Now, you know, that really hit me, because I remember, you know, years ago when I first started reading through what was then available about the Kennedy assassination and the conspiracy, many of these books would go through, you know, showing you how the Warren Commission was issuing a lie and how things didn't add up. But when you get to the very end, there always seemed to be something missing to me, which was, I guess we could put it this way. Okay, the CIA was, you know, on the ground organizing the whole thing. And Dulles was the point man, let's say. But what was above the CIA? Who were they working for? Who, you know, what about the level above the CIA? Because the CIA is really, you know, the police force that protects the economic elite, the 0.01%. Very few of these assassination books ever deal with that. But in 1967, he's already talking about the economic strata that the media is serving. And, you know, this book also, I think we need to say, you know, Murder Most Foul itself doesn't exist in a vacuum, because he produced four major books about the assassinations. The last one came out the year of 1992, when Oliver Stone made JFK. And so there's, you know, there's an evolution of thought, but there's also, you know, leitmotif that is repeated throughout and stated in different ways. And for example, he's got a book called Watch What We Do, Not What We Say. Came out in 1971. It's an attack on the Nixon administration. But it raises a lot of these points about, you know, above and beyond the level of the CIA, there's a barely visible force that utilizes the agency as its police force, the economic elite. Donald Gibson, you know, the great author on the CIA assassinations, JFK assassination, you know, he expands this in his books like Battling Wall Street, which came out in 94, Kennedy assassination cover-up came in the year 2000. But Stanley's already touching on this in 1967. In the book he wrote about the Nixon administration in 1971, for example, back then people called it the establishment. You remember that line where you talk about the establishment? Right? And he says, so he's talking about the establishment. This is how he sums it up. He says, it can be said that not more than 8,000 persons out of a population of 215 million comprise the establishment. They control every major decision, foreign and domestic, made in the nation. It is not a conspiracy, but a meeting of the minds. They sincerely believe that what is good for them is good for the country.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. You know, I can give you a quote that Fletcher Cody often told me. He said, when you think of the CIA, the last letter is the most important.
Agency. Yeah, I'm sorry, Len, who said that?
Fletcher, Prouty.
Oh, Fletcher, yeah, right.
Right,
right.
Because he said that, think of the agency working like as a law firm for a client.
Right.
So if you're thinking of the agency, who is its client, right? Is it the Department of Defense, or like you're mentioning, higher? Alan Dulles, Sullivan Cromwell, the real people who own and run America.
Yes.
And they come to him, and when he's fired, they still come to him. He's working with Sullivan Cromwell, one of the most prestigious law firms in America.
In fact, in my longer version of this, I cited and quoted from Fletcher Prouty from the preface of his second edition. He says that intelligence gathering is akin to a cover story for the agency, because although it does gather information, its real task is to serve as a willing tool of a higher level secret team that usually includes representatives of the CIA and other instrumentalities of the government, certain cells of the business and professional world, and almost always foreign participation. So I actually said that about Fletcher, that, you know, that's secret team was 1972. That's even before Donald Gibson. You know, Fletcher was hip to this, as you know better than I, because you're the expert on Fletcher.
Well, you know, there's a couple of times you mentioned, I hope we can get back to that later. Did you make a note of some things you'd like to bring up I don't want to miss that you thought were an important topic?
Oh, yeah.
Good.
Yeah, so, yeah, a couple of these things I thought were really interesting. Like, let's see. First one I want to talk about was the Chicago Defender newspaper. I thought this was a really interesting piece of work that he did, and I think probably as a result of the publication of his book on the Soviet Union, The Bear That Walks Like a Man. Now, that came out in February of 43. So in April, at the end of April, Stanley started to do these weekly book reviews for the Chicago Defender newspaper. And again, it was the most widely circulated black newspaper in America. It had a circulation of 200,000 by the early 1920s. It's still in existence. And they gave him a weekly feature column on military strategy and tactics. By the way, in one of these articles that he wrote, he talks about IG Farben, you know, the Nazi-connected company. And I'm thinking, wow, like Alan Dulles would not be happy to see this article in 1943 because of Sullivan and Cromwell's connection to Farben. And then he also did a weekly book review. Again, mostly, you know, books on politics. And I mentioned before how this newspaper basically single-handedly created the Great Northern Drive campaign, which kick-started the great migration of African Americans to the North, which, you know, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI were certainly not very happy about. One thing I wanted to mention that I found fascinating is this thing called the Dual Victory Campaign. Had you ever heard of that before you looked at this, Len?
No, not at all.
Isn't that an interesting phenomenon? You know, my father, who's in his 90s now, you know, he's read every important book on World War II. He's lifelong liberal. I learned a lot from him. Also, you know, fascinated by the civil rights movement. He'd never heard of this. So during World War II, the Chicago Defender and other black press leaders promoted this thing called the Double V campaign, in which they called for a dual victory over both foreign and domestic enemies of racial inequality, of racial equality. And it started in January 1942. This guy named James Thompson, this African-American guy, wrote a letter to the editor. And it was called "Should I Sacrifice to Live Half American?" And what he's referring to there is, you know, there was this great drive to, you know, join the army and fight for America during World War II. But what would happen if you were African American? You come back from the war and you're living, you know, as half an American, not with the rights of everyone else. So he wrote this letter to the editor. And it exploded. It was like so many people in the black communities in America reacted to what he said, that they created this thing called the Double V campaign. You've heard of Victory Gardens, Len? During World War II?
Okay, no, I haven't heard of Victory Gardens.
What's that?
Sorry, I hadn't heard of that.
Yeah, so Victory Gardens, like, that's well known. Victory Gardens were this thing where they encouraged people to grow their own vegetables, which would help with food rationing. And so they were called Victory Gardens. So the black community started this thing called Double V Gardens, Double V baseball games, Double V dances. There was even a Double V hairdo. And they created Double V clubs that organized protests and that met with business leaders to encourage them to hire African Americans. They met with congressmen. It was an incredible campaign. And the FDR administration was absolutely terrified by this. And so at first, J. Edgar Hoover, who I realized from doing this research, you know, FDR, he's supposed to be this great liberal and everything, he really mollycoddled Hoover. And he was very happy to use Hoover's dirt, you know, when journalists were attacking FDR and so on. He encouraged Hoover to build up all these files. And so at first, J. Edgar Hoover actually convinced FDR to allow him to prosecute the editors and leaders of these black newspapers under the Sedition Act. So FDR agreed, yeah, we got to stop this double V thing. You know, let's prosecute them for treason. I'd never heard of this story before until I started researching the Chicago Defender. So what happened was, this was around 1940, and the Defender had been taken over by the nephew of the founder. The founder, by the way, Robert Abbott, he created this paper with 25 cents, which would have been about $7 today. He was trained as a printmaker, but couldn't get a job. You know, he worked in offset lithography, but he couldn't get a job because he was black. They wouldn't hire him. So he created his own newspaper. And when he died, his nephew took over. His nephew's name was John Sengstack. Really incredible guy, very courageous guy. In 1940, Sengstack created this thing called the Negro National Newspaper Publishing Association, which represented African-American-owned newspapers. And so when the word came down that Hoover was going to try to lock these guys up for treason, Sengstack reached out to Eleanor Roosevelt. And Eleanor helped to arrange a meeting between him and Attorney General Francis Biddle. This is in June 1942. So the meeting was arranged, and Biddle, to his great credit, and by the way, I realized afterwards, this guy, Francis Biddle, he was one of the only sane voices of liberalism, really, in the high-ranking FDR administration. Only Biddle stood between J. Edgar Hoover and disaster. And so Biddle actually listened to Sengstack and listened to his argument about why they were doing this and how, you know, they were suffering all these injustices and this is what they had to do. And Sengstack refused to back down. He was like, if you want to prosecute me for treason, fine, but we're not going to stop. And so these two men, minus the poisonous presence of J. Edgar Hoover, actually agreed to a compromise. And Sengstack agreed that the papers would not intensify the dual victory campaign. In return, they would not be prosecuted. So Hoover was furious about this, and he continued, of course, to monitor the papers. And you can download FBI files that were kept on the Chicago Defender and the other papers. But Biddle prevented it from happening. A really incredible man, and he was the only Attorney General Biddle, who was the nominal boss of Hoover. He was the only high-ranking FDR official who opposed the forced internment of Japanese Americans during the war. He wasn't successful in stopping that, but once it began in 1943, he asked the president to close the camps, calling it repugnant to the principles of our government. And FDR refused to close the camps until another year had passed. After FDR, Truman appointed Biddle to serve as a judge at the Nuremberg trials. And, you know, although there were some anarchist press prosecutions during World War II as a result of pressure that came from FDR and Hoover, if Biddle had stepped down, we would have been in a total mess. You know, so this is just an interesting guy that very few people know about.
Yeah, this whole research that you're doing into these topics is so interesting.
Well, that's why, you know, I was saying before about him being a Zelig-like figure, because almost every place that Marx positions himself, there's this whole other amazing story that opens up. And so, you know, no wonder they blacklisted him. It takes about 2.5 years to get an FBI file now, but I can't wait to... You know, and I don't know quite how to do it yet, but once I finish researching that, eventually I think we're going to find some very interesting FBI files on Stanley Marx.
Well, very good. Well, I'm going to urge everyone to read your review
And if anybody's lucky enough to find the book for now, I guess it's going to be next to impossible to find until you get something reprinted. So maybe I can offer some help with that.
That would be great, Lynn. We would really appreciate that. And can you give a shout-out, hello to Bobby Marks? I know she's going to be listening.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, for sure. But I'll just, you know, I'll talk to you through email, whatever help I can offer.
And let me congratulate you again on the amazing work you did. And you did it. You just had this anniversary of your 1,000th program. What year did you first start doing this, Lynn?
2000.
Wow. Yeah. So it's solid 20 years. Who was your first interview subject?
Greg Burnham. We had planned 10. Me and Anita had planned 10 episodes. So, you know, just marked out. Okay, well, you know, let's talk to, you know, him and him. You know, because I had worked just with Fletcher Prouty for so long.
Right.
I thought, well, I don't want to end up, you know, tackling a whole book in that. But it'd be nice to just to talk to people. And it just happened by accident again. John Barber has told me this. He said, listen, if you ever plan something, back up from it. But the best things in life are those that happen by accident. I stumbled into this. I stumbled into working with John Barber on his documentary by accident and many things. And, it just that though at my recording studio, these other ladies were doing a talk show and they wanted to rehearse. And I was like, what? This is easy. I can do this. I can figure out how to stream to the internet. I can archive everything and just, hey, I never dreamed it would be that easy.
Mm-hmm.
So we said, let's get 10 authors or people that you've always wanted to talk to and do that.
So who were some of the first 10 in that group that stand out?
Oh, I don't recall. I think Bill Davey had to be up there.
Oh, he's great.
The first, I remember it was great getting Michael Rupert on. Michael Rupert, Donald Gibson, Bill Davey, April Oliver, Sherman Skolnick, Jim Mars, Gene Hill, Jay Truman, Virginia McCullough, right? And then from then on, it was like Scott Enyart, David Ratcliffe, Raymond Gallup, Jack White, Barbara Malarkey, Betty Martini, Doug Valentine, Robert Thorne, Steve Smith. Oh, Steve Smith, they're making a movie about his effort. He contacted me, and he'll be a guest coming on. He was a victim of MK Ultra mind control.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, just people that were interesting.
That's a great lineup. And how long have you and Jim DiEugenio known each other and been doing work together?
I don't know, to tell you the truth.
It's been a while, right?
You know, 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I really enjoyed having a co-host. Due to one reason or the other, Anita couldn't do it anymore. I think we were maybe 6 or 7 years.
Right.
And then I had a kind of an association with Jim Fetzer, that he was on every second week, and I didn't mind some of his early work, but we had a falling out. Luckily, he just went on a little sideways, so I'm glad to disassociate from that. But every second week, I ended up just slowly having Jim on, and one of the attributes of that is that Jim would take questions, and a lot of people would email in questions, and I think me and Anita did one show where we had a call-in. And it went sideways so fast that we went, okay, never again. You know, never again. If people want to ask something, let's get them to write it down ahead of time and we can go through them. And to his credit, Jim reads like the good and the bad. You know, some people are, you know, not complimentary, but, you know, we do this for free. It's a volunteer. It's a community service that
Absolutely.
We look into a topic. I've been doing it for quite a while. Like I said to you, at least I have the advantage of I don't work for anybody, so if somebody I don't agree with them or I don't want to know about that book, I don't even want to have them on, I don't have them on, and that's it. And luckily, there are still new things to talk about. I'm surprised. I'm thinking, how can you talk about this for 20 years? But here, you have just brought up an author who has, you said, about 20 books, and there's about 4 or 5 I should read. So now I'm going to have to try to dig up number one and then go on from there. But there are still things of interest if you're looking into this topic.
Oh, for sure.
And look at Oliver Stone is coming out this fall with a new, you know, 4-part documentary. And according to Jim, you know, there's a lot of stuff they have to leave off. Some of these people will have a director's cut where you can get all the interviews later, which is
fantastic.
A real benefit. But, you know, so, yeah, there are still things to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even with Marx, right? Like, some of these books, a lot of them, are available in libraries. You know, I did a search online, university libraries quite often. They'll have Murder, Most Foul or some of the other books. But there's a couple that do not exist in any library and do not exist in the, even in the Library of Congress, because he was very careful about getting his books into the Library of Congress, you know. But the play he wrote, which I would love to have a copy of, late 1970, he wrote this play. Originally it was called Murder's Most Foul. And then he kept changing the title, like sometimes it's called A Time to Die, A Time to Cry. That's the most common title. So this play about the three main assassinations of the 60s, and you can't find it anywhere. And, you know, it's really funny because I went online, I guess it was Google Books, and I found this book I'd never seen before. It's called, like, I think it's called The JFK Assassination Almanac. And it lists, like, every book that was in existence at that time. And they actually mention the play. But all it says is, you know, performance unknown. So it's, like, so close and so far, you know?
Well, if anyone knows about this, email me. I'll be glad to pass that on to you.
So very good.
People know of any of all these books or plays or manuscripts or anything they may have kicking around that we don't know about. Be glad to know about that. Okay, well, I think we've kind of covered that for now.
Thank you, Len.
Before we wrap up, though, I always offer, is there anything that I didn't get to, or I give you time now if there's anything else you wanted to bring up?
I think you did a great job, and one of the things I love about your show is not only are you so knowledgeable about all this, but you bring a great deal of enthusiasm to your shows. And I think listeners really appreciate your sincerity and enthusiasm. So I want to thank you.
Okay. Well, no problem. It might be that I generally have a good cup of coffee before I start.
That's my trick also.
Yeah.
All right. You take care. Have a good day, Len.
All right. Thank you so much. Rob Couteau, and anything, what are you working on next then?
What am I working on next? I think right now I'm just going to be continuing to try to dig up some more things about Stanley J. Marx. There are things that are not available online. Like, to give you one example, he apparently wrote regularly for the Chicago Daily News and the Chicago Sun. That would have been like in the late 1930s, early 40s. He also did CBS radio broadcasts around that time. And he also wrote for a paper in California. I believe it was called The California Jewish Voice. That exists in microfilm at the New York Public Library, which is closed right now because of the virus. So these are some places that in the near future, I hope to be digging up some more stuff about him.
Do you have a website or Facebook page that people want to know more about you? That you
absolutely
want to advertise?
Yes, thank you. It's just robcouteau.com, and again, the last name is spelled Couteau.com. Robcouteau.com.
Okay, very good. We'll make links to that.
Thank you, Len.
All right, we're looking forward to speaking to you again on whatever you want to bring to our attention, and thank you for this really interesting story about someone I had no idea about, Stanley J. Marx. I'm going to have to look into that.
Very good. You take care, Len. Bye-bye for now. Bye.